Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Cynthia McClure. Our stories today will be the 100th anniversary of The Passenger Pigeon by Aldo Leopold, read by Pat Schlarbaum. Kay Puttock's Community Service Announcement Appreciation segment is with lead interim pastor John Carr from the Bethesda Lutheran Church in Ames. And also, we are remembering a longtime supporter of KHOI, Professor of Chemistry, Bob McCarley. By his pastor, Dave Russell, and a colleague at Iowa State University, Bob Calabrese, who is a retired chemistry professor. But first, the weather. Here are what conditions today will be like for Ames and surrounding communities. Tonight, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. Cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny, with the high near 79 degrees. Southwest winds around 10 miles per hour, becoming west-northwest in the afternoon. New rainfall amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Tonight, a 20% chance of showers, thunderstorms after 1 a.m. Partly cloudy with a low around 58 degrees. Northwest winds 5 to 7 miles per hour. Tuesday, mostly sunny with highs near 81. West-southwest winds 5 to 9 miles per hour. Tuesday night, mostly clear with a low around 60. Up next, we have a phonology report by Pat Schlarbaum, which is in commemoration of The Passenger Pigeon. The story is by Aldo Leopold and read by Pat Schlarbaum.
Today's phonology will be the 100th anniversary of the death of the last passenger pigeon. September 1, 1914, Martha, the last captive passenger pigeon, died at the Cincinnati Zoo. She outlasted George, the penultimate survivor of her species and her only companion, by 4 years. The fact that we can pinpoint the death of the last known passenger pigeon is one of many peculiarities that distinguish this species. Many thousands of species go extinct every year, but we tend to be unaware of their passing. The passenger pigeon's decline was impossible to ignore, because as recently as the 1880s, it was the most abundant vertebrate in North America. It made up as much as 40% of the continent's bird population. In A Feathered River Across the Sky, Joel Greenberg suggests that the species population may have exceeded that of every other bird on the planet. Their flocks expanded to a mile wide and up to 300 miles long. They were so dense that they darkened the sky for hours, and then for days as the flock passed overhead. In 1860, a naturalist observed a single flock that he estimated to contain 3.7 billion passenger pigeons. By comparison, there are currently 260 million pigeons or rock doves in existence today. Probably the most terrible example of mass slaughter in the history of wildlife was not the bison, but the passenger pigeon, a story that almost defies belief. The early Europeans in North America frequently commented on the huge numbers of blue, long-tailed, fast and graceful passenger pigeons in the country. One of the first settlers in Virginia wrote that, "There are wild pigeons in winter beyond number or imagination. Myself have seen 3 or 4 hours together flocks in the air, so thick that even they shadowed the sky from us." As late as 1854 in Wayne County, New York, a local resident wrote that, "There would be days and days when the air was alive with them, hardly a break occurring in the flocks for half a day at a time. Flocks stretched as far as a person could see, one tier above another." Other reports describe flocks a mile wide, flying overhead for 4 or 5 hours at a time during their migration in the early spring from the south to their breeding areas in New England. The flocks were so thickly packed that a single shot could bring down 30 or 40 birds, and many were killed simply by hitting them with pieces of wood as they flew over hilltops. In 1947, a plaque commemorating the extinction of the passenger pigeon was placed at Wyalusing State Park, across from Iowa's Pikes Peak State Park, near McGregor, Iowa. The dedication included a speech by Aldo Leopold on a monument to the pigeon. "We have erected a monument to commemorate the funeral of a species. It symbolizes our sorrow. We grieve because no living man will see again the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds, sweeping a path for spring across the March skies, chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies. Men still live who, in their youth, remember pigeons. Trees still live who, in their youth, were shaken by a living wind. But a decade hence, only the oldest oaks will remember, and at long last, only the hills will know. There will always be pigeons in books and in museums, but these are effigies and images, dead to all hardships and to all delights. Book pigeons cannot dive out of a cloud to make the deer run for cover, or clap their wings in thunderous applause of mass-laden woods. Book pigeons cannot breakfast on new-mown wheat in Minnesota and dine on blueberries in Canada. They know no urge of seasons. They feel no kiss of sun, no lash of wind and weather. They live forever by not living at all. Our grandfathers were less well-housed, well-fed, well-clothed than we are. The strivings by which they bettered their lot are also those which deprived us of pigeons. Perhaps we now grieve because we are not sure in our hearts that we have gained by the exchange. The gadgets of industry bring us more comforts than the pigeons did, but do they add as much to the glory of the spring? It is a century now since Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the origin of species. We know now what was unknown to all the preceding caravan of generations, that men are only fellow voyagers with other creatures in the odyssey of evolution. This new knowledge should have given us, by this time, a sense of kinship with fellow creatures, a wish to live and let live, a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of the biotic enterprise. Above all, we should, in the century since Darwin, have come to know that man, while now captain of the adventuring ship, is hardly the sole object of its quest, and that his prior assumptions to this effect arose from the simple necessity of whistling in the dark. These things, I say, should have come to us. I fear that they have not come to many. For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun. The Cro-Magnon who slew the last mammoth thought only of stakes. The sportsman who shot the last pigeon thought only of prowess. The sailor who clubbed the last auk thought of nothing at all. But we, who have lost our pigeons, mourn the loss. Had the funeral been ours, the pigeons would hardly have mourned us. And this fact, rather than in Mr. DuPont's nylons or Mr. Vannevar Bush's bombs, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. This monument, perched like a duck hawk on this cliff, will scan this wide valley, watching through the days and years. For many a march, it will watch the geese go by, telling the river about clearer, colder, lonelier waters on the tundra. For many an April, it will see the redbuds come and go, and for many a May, the flush of oak blooms on a thousand hills. Questing wood ducks will search these basswoods for hollow limbs. Golden prothonotaries will shake golden pollen from the river willows. Egrets will pose on these sloughs in August. Plovers will whistle from September skies. Hickory nuts will plop into October leaves, and hail will rattle in November woods. But no pigeons will pass, for there are no pigeons, save only this flightless one, graven in bronze on this rock. Tourists will read this inscription, but their thoughts will not take wing. We are told by economic moralists that to mourn the pigeon is mere nostalgia, that if the pigeoners had not done away with him, the farmers would ultimately have obliged, in self-defense, to do so. This is one of those peculiar truths that are valid, but not for the reasons alleged. The pigeon was a biological storm. He was the lightning that played between two opposing potentials of intolerable intensity, the fat of the land, and the oxygen of the air. Yearly, the feathered tempest roared up, down, and across the continent, sucking up the laden fruits of forest and prairie, burning them in a traveling blast of life. Like any other chain reaction, the pigeon could survive no diminution of his own furious intensity. When the pigeoners subtracted from his numbers, and the pioneers chopped gaps in the continuity of his fuel, his flame guttered out with hardly a sputter or even a wisp of smoke. Today the oaks still flaunt their burden at the sky, but the feathered lightning is no more. Worm and weevil must now perform slowly and silently the biological task that once drew thunder from the firmament. The wonder is not that the pigeon went out, but that he ever survived through all the millennia of pre-Babidian time. The pigeon loved his land. He lived by the intensity of his desire for clustered grape and bursting beechnut, and by his contempt of miles and seasons. Whatever Wisconsin did not offer him gratis today, he sought and found tomorrow in Michigan, or Labrador, or Tennessee. His love was for the present things, and these things were present somewhere. To find them required only the free sky and the will to ply his wings. To love what was is a new thing under the sun, unknown to most people and to all pigeons. To see America as history, to conceive of destiny as a becoming, to smell a hickory tree through the still lapses of ages, all these things are possible for us, and to achieve them takes only the free sky and the will to ply our wings. In these things, and not in Mr. Bush's bombs and Mr. DuPont's nylons, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. Alda Leopold, 1947, on a monument to the pigeon. I'll point out that Mr. Leopold's reference to Bush's bombs, that's Vannevar Bush, he's referring to the man who headed up 6,000 scientists connecting science to warfare and applied that knowledge to the Manhattan Project, among others. And that's our phonology for September 1, 2014.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world. Sweet the rain's new fall, sunlit from heaven, like the first dew fall on the first grass. Praise for the sweetness of the red garden, sprung in completeness where his feet pass.
There will be a couple discussions coming up concerning wildness in Iowa on Tuesday evening, September 2nd at 6:30 to 8:30. Chris Adkins, naturalist extraordinaire with the Dallas County Conservation Board, and Dallas Chief Eagle from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, will present 50 Years of the Wilderness Act, Is There Wild in Iowa? At Jester Park Lodge on the west shore of the Saylorville Reservoir near Granger, Iowa. Then on Wednesday, September 3rd, Chris will join us here at Local Talk to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act that was signed into law on September 3, 1964, by President Lyndon Johnson. We will also be joined by Howard Crow Eagle of the Navajo Nation to discuss their upcoming Prairie Awakening for Saturday, September 6th, from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Keene Conservation Area, which is about 6 miles southwest of Adel in Dallas County. So plan to join us on Wednesday to learn about 50-year anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act.
That was Pat Schlarbaum reading a work by Alda Leopold, which is commemorating the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, as well as some upcoming events that you can be a part of to support wildlife conservation. It's the beginning of September, which means it's a new month for our community service organization appreciation. This is a regular feature here at KHOI by our reporter, Kay Puttick. The organization for this month is Bethesda Lutheran Church, or rather, the various community service missions run by the church located at 1517 Northwestern Avenue, Ames. Later in the interview, we'll hear how the street address, 1517, is significant, and perhaps it can also help us all remember the date of an important historical event. Kay Puttick's guest for today, lead interim pastor, John Carr. As a relative newcomer to Ames, Pastor John tells us about his impression of our community here in Ames, as well as about the different community service ministries offered at Bethesda Lutheran Church here in Ames.
My guest this morning for our Community Service Appreciation Program is Pastor John Kerr from Bethesda Lutheran Church. Welcome, Pastor John. I'm so glad you could come.
Thank you.
With our Community Service Appreciation Program, KHOI has been spreading the word about the wonderful work that's being done by many different nonprofit service organizations in Ames and the surrounding communities. Each month, we feature a different service organization. And this month, our organization is Bethesda Lutheran, which is really a number of organizations because they do so many wonderful things for the community and abroad, too. And that's what we're going to hear about this morning. Now, Pastor John, I'd like you to start by introducing yourself a bit because you're relatively new to the community and to Bethesda Lutheran.
Yes, I am, Kay. I'm the interim lead pastor at Bethesda, and I've been here since October 1st of 2013. I come from the Twin Cities. I'm a Lutheran pastor that spent 20 years in a parish up there and then retired back in 2005 and decided I wanted to do interim work because in the four parishes, full-time called parishes I had interim pastors there before I came. Uh-huh. And I saw the marvelous work of transition that they were doing and decided that I wanted to offer something back to the church after I retired. Still had a lot of energy and so that's what I've been doing since 2005 is interim work around the country.
Is the work of an interim pastor different from the work of a, what you might call a regular pastor?
Not really. No, we do all of the same word and sacrament ministry that a regular pastor does. I did receive training a number of years ago, to become an interim pastor. There are certain things that we address while we are interim pastors that probably normal pastors or full-time called pastors don't address necessarily. Okay. And help the congregation look at themselves,
right,
prepare for that new pastor that they're going to receive.
We're here to mainly to talk about the wonderful services that the church provides. Mm-hmm. And this morning while we were chatting, you told me about some of the things which are probably less well-known, certainly to me, the Chicatini Parish.
Yes.
And the Scandinavian Coffee.
The Scandinavian Coffee is in October at our church. It's a one-day event where the women of the parish prepare all of these marvelous, delicious Scandinavian desserts, and then they have crafts that different individuals have made throughout the year, and they sell those, and then the proceeds go for mission projects. Chicatini is a parish in northwest Tanzania. It's in the Pari Diocese near Arusha, and that's a local rural community congregation that the church has been in contact with and in ministry with for a number of years. I don't know exactly how many years. The Scandinavian Coffee's been going on for about 46, 47 years, so that's a long-time ministry of the church.
I think a lot of people have perhaps already heard of your food pantry and the clothing closet, and so perhaps we should concentrate on those today.
Sure.
The food pantry has quite an interesting history, how it began and how it served during the flood and so on. The flood of, what was it, 93?
93, yes. Yes, the food pantry has been in operation for 31 years, as I understand. They serve close to 17,000 individuals a year, and I found an interesting statistic that last year they took in over 125,000 pounds of food that have been donated by individuals and grocery stores in the community. And it's not all just Bethesda. There are about 70 different organizations that contribute money and food to the food pantry. And there are about as many 70 different individuals that volunteer. There's no paid persons right. connected with
and
the food
the
pantry.
The volunteers might not necessarily be churchgoers.
Church members, no,
church
that's
members.
Exactly right. Yeah,
okay.
I think the majority perhaps come from Bethesda, but they represent all religious groups, faith groups within the community.
So it would be all right for us to put a plug out for more volunteers.
You bet. Yeah, I'm sure.
That sounds like quite a storage problem. You must have a lot of space to store.
We do. Matter of fact, they take up, I would say it's at least four classrooms on the first floor, three or four classrooms, and they have their own refrigerators and freezers, and it's quite interesting just to go back and see how they've got the food organized. And it's quite an operation. I haven't observed everything in the short time I've been here, but I hear about it and I see them down there working, and they keep everything under lock and key because they have a lot of expensive equipment back there. And the process that they go through is very, very well organized, as you might imagine, after 31 years.
Yes,
and they've had some very key people with some organizational skills that have been a part of the volunteers. And the volunteers that they get come from all walks of life, and not just people who necessarily are out of work or don't work or have retired.
And now, the hours of the food pantry are Monday and Wednesday mornings, Tuesday and Thursday afternoons.
That's
and
correct.
Tuesday evenings.
That's correct.
And this is at the church.
Yes.
What is the address of the church?
The address of the church is 1517 Northwestern Avenue. There's an interesting story about where 1517 came from. They got to choose their house number.
Uh-huh.
And 1517 happens to be the year Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the castle church door in Wittenberg, Germany.
On
October 31st, the day before All Saints Day, because he knew there was going to be a crowd of people in Wittenberg to read and debate his 95 theses.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Presumably, the food that you store there at the food pantry is non-perishable stuff like, well, Barilla pasta and canned goods. But you also have a way of getting fresh produce, I believe, out to people from the food pantry.
Yes, they do. And some of the grocery stores bring that. I can't explain to you, you know, they have the refrigeration where they can keep perishable food longer, or they can freeze food. I know I happened to be there one day when they bought these little cuties. They're like tangerines, you know, the small tangerines.
Oh, right.
The seedless.
Right,
yes.
Delicious.
They brought in, I don't know how many pallets of that to hand out from one of the local food stores.
Have you seen changes in the need or increased use of the pantry in recent – well, of course, you haven't been there long. But
no, I haven't. I haven't been there long enough to see that. But I do know that the types of people that they serve are varied. They tell me that individuals from broken families come in, obviously homeless people, people with only one income in the family. Maybe they had two incomes and then the family broke up and now they're down to one income. People who have no job or lost their job, laid off, unable to find work, disabled people, single mothers, people who have medical problems.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a variety of people who use the services.
Okay, and let's move on to the clothing closet then.
Yeah, the clothing closet's down. Unfortunately, it's in the basement of our educational unit, and we don't have an elevator. And so that's a disadvantage. But they, again, service the same kinds of people that I just mentioned in regard to the food pantry. I think there was only about one time that the clothing closet was closed, and that was back in 2011 when they were putting in the geothermal system that we have for heating and cooling our church. And
so you're very environmentally responsible.
Oh, very much so. Matter of fact, we have a committee called the COOL committee, and it's a green committee of the church, which encourages our members to go green. So they are very much environmentally alert and concerned. But it was during that time, and I think that was the only time in the history that they had to close.
Now, again, there must be a storage concern here.
There is.
And I noticed you want in-season clothing.
Yes.
So you don't have to store
good,
a lot of...
Or new clothing and in-season and shoes, too, that are in-season.
Quite often people that have been unemployed for a while, when they start looking for a job, they need the kind of clothes that you would go to an interview in, and, you know, maybe a suit or smarter clothes than people wear at weekends.
And they have those kinds of clothes, yes. And they also have bedding. As a matter of fact, when I was looking for an apartment when I arrived last October, some of the ladies brought up some sheets and pillowcases for me because they figured I was going to need them. My wife and I would need them. We had brought some from the Twin Cities, but that alerted me to the fact that they had bedding there as well for families.
Oh, that would be very useful, especially.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's something you'd appreciate donations of.
Yes.
Sheets, blankets, things like that.
Blankets, quilts. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the clothing closet is open 3 days a week, I believe.
Yes, they are, and I'm sorry that I don't have the times of that. You can call the church, or the church office can give you that that information.
Now, you have a preschool, too, a Christian preschool.
We do, yes. They meet on the second floor of our educational building, or a portion of that. I think that preschool has been around almost 50 years or more. It's a long-standing outreach into the community that we have.
Well, it looked like a wonderful program.
It is. It is.
And it's for children ages 3 to 5.
Yes.
And there's very little space. There's usually a waiting list for the different sessions.
There is. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, these sound like wonderful services that you have.
And that's a blessing of the church. Our public school system got started in the church in England,
right.
and Sunday schools got started there. And churches are free to pioneer those social services. I've always said the church is a servant, as Jesus was a servant. And that's what we should be in the community, a servant. And Bethesda has always had that motto. And has taken that stance of serving the community. And that's probably one of our strengths as a congregation.
Actually, something I've wondered, where does the name Bethesda come from? I should know this because I used to teach the Bible as a literature. But
well, yeah, the woman at the well and the Bethesda, that's where that comes from.
So the story was she came for water and Jesus said, if you have the water I give you, you won't drink again. You won't need to fill again. Was that the story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. And in the back of the – well, I call it the back of the church. It's really the front of the church. The front of our church is on Northwestern Avenue, but the back of the church, which most people would call it, there is a symbolic well back there painted on the pavement, and then there's an iron structure with a cross on the top, symbolizing that well of Bethesda.
Of living water.
Of living water,
right.
Yes. Yes.
Well, that's a lovely story.
Yeah.
A beautiful connection. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, it's good to be in the Ames community. I have served an interim parishes in various communities that have had universities, and I have told a number of the university people, I've never lived in a community where the university and the community kind of are all meshed together and supported. And that's a joy. My wife Diana and I have enjoyed living in the Ames community, and I can certainly see why a lot of graduates from ISU and professors decide to come back and live here or to just make their home here after they graduate from the university.
Ames really grows on you. It's a,
it does.
It's a nice
it really does. We're just amazed at how many keep coming back and wanting to live here. It's been a marvelous experience for both of us.
thank you so much for coming today and for telling us about the services at Bethesda Lutheran.
You're welcome.
And
my pleasure.
Welcome to Ames.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
My guest today has been Pastor John Kerr of Bethesda Lutheran Church, and he's been telling us something about the various community services provided by the church. We'll put the relevant information on our website, and we'll be talking more this month, I hope, with perhaps representatives of the Shigatini Mission and the people that work in the clothes closet. You'll be hearing more about Bethesda Lutheran this month. Thank you again, Pastor John.
You're welcome.
That was reporter Kay Puttick talking with lead interim pastor John Carr of Bethesda Lutheran Church in Ames. If you have a community service organization that you would like to be featured on Local Talk, contact Kay Puttick at khoiradio@gmail.org. Each month, she features a different community service organization with at least one interview and also public service announcements featuring the chosen organization each day throughout the month. The Community Food Pantry and the Clothing Closet of Bethesda Lutheran are both located at the church at 1517 Northwestern Avenue. Hours of operation can be found at the church's website, bethesdanet.org, under the menu of Bethesda Ministries. Up next, a remembrance of a long-term supporter of KHOI, Robert Bob McCarley, who recently passed away, by friends of his who knew him and have a personal remembrance of him. This is Cynthia McClure. I'm with Pastor Dave Russell. He is the pastor of the Ames First Baptist Church. I brought Mr. Russell in because a supporter of KHOI, Robert Bob McCarley, passed away. And we brought in his pastor to talk about him. You knew him well. I didn't know him at all. I mean, I may have known him in passing. So can you convey to our listening audience what he was like?
Yeah. Well, my family moved here 15 years ago. This in September, it'll be 15 years. And Bob and Jenna were among the first people that we met, really. I mean, invited us over their house right away. Very warm, draw people in. Bob, he grew up in Texas on a dairy farm. And so his early years, he'd get up at 3 in the morning every day to milk the cows, do the chores, go to school. He really knew how to, you know, to work hard. Went to college, went to chemistry, University of Texas. And then he and Jenna both say they escaped Texas, or she escaped Oklahoma. She lived right across the river from him in Oklahoma. They escaped, came up to Iowa State, and he was a longtime chemistry professor and chair of the department for a few years. Very sharp. He worked long hours. I mean, really worked hard. But at the same time, he wasn't just in this ivory tower kind of person. He was real practical, results-oriented. Maybe that's from growing up milking cows every morning. So he really got involved in a lot of different ways in the community. I didn't know him. I had the impression he was kind of one of the Young Turk types, you know. So like one story was he grew a mustache at a time when I guess faculty weren't doing that, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, the rebel,
and,
huh?
Anyway, so the department chair had a talk with him. You know, it's come to my attention. You've got a caterpillar growing on your upper lip or something stupid, you know. And Bob said, well, he went home and he thought about it, that, and he decided he needed to grow a beard. So
so he wasn't really conformist. He did what he wanted.
Yeah, yeah. But as far as the community, you know, they in the 60s and 70s, our church kind of was at the forefront of a lot of social involvement in town. So they had a hand in starting Northcrest, the retirement community. The Jewish congregation met in our church for 7 years before they had their own building.
So he was very inclusive, and he wanted to make Ames better.
Yeah, yeah. And the Center for Creative Justice was a big part of that. So there was a group, and Jenna, his wife, was very involved in that. There's a group that wanted to do something for people in the criminal justice system, particularly people who were just getting out of prison, get them reintegrated into society. That's kind of where it started. What it wound up was community-based volunteer probation supervision for people who otherwise wouldn't have any no supervision at all. You'd either get a fine or a jail time and you're out. But so CCJ's been around 40 years.
They helped found the Center for Creative Justice.
Helped start that, continue to support that. He's been involved with Habitat for Humanity, you know, both I know financially, I mean, he's quiet about this, but I know he supported a lot of these causes in town, but also built houses and just a, you know, encouraging supporter.
Robert McCarley, who just passed away August 19th, he made an impact.
Yeah, I mean, so. I think more recently, you know, he was involved in a lot of stuff. He was involved in politics, but it wasn't like because he was rooting for the home team. You know, so, you know, I'm for the Democrats. Yay, it's the team, you know.
He wasn't partisan.
But he just wanted to make a difference, you know, and he could get really upset. I had a lot of Sunday school classes with him, and he'd periodically get on some soapbox and just about, you know, the narrow-mindedness and short-sightedness and this is dragging our country down, you know. I mean, he had a sense of what was going on and what needed to happen, and he was just real concerned about justice, so that things should be right and fair and opportunity for everybody, you know. So I think, like climate change was his big thing lately. He was in the last few years he was really concerned about. But as a scientist, you know, he understood that. As a grandfather, he was concerned for his kids. And as a person of faith, he felt like, you know, we're called to care for this world God's given us. So he kind of pulled together all of these different concerns he had.
In the broader picture, we wanted to talk about him because he supported KHOI, and he was there from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the man. I may have seen him, but yeah. Like a lot of people in Ames that are supporters of KHOI, they're in the background, and they're involved with a lot of things to make Ames better. And you, as a pastor, you see these people and you interact with these people that make Ames better, but they do it quietly. If there's somebody out there listening and they want to make change, how could they do that?
Yeah.
You know, what would you recommend?
Yeah. I think just find something that you care about, you know, if you're passionate about, and get involved. You know, I think for Bob, it's not like single-handedly he wasn't going to turn around the problem of global warming. But if everybody said, I can't do, you know, just me, I can't do anything, if everybody had that attitude, then nothing would ever get done. Like KHOI, for example, he thought it was a great idea. In fact, when you guys started, you know, you were in an upstairs room in our church until you had this, you know, fabulous pantorium. I think Bob May, he was on trustees. He may be in the trustee chair even when that, you know, we talked with Roger about when you started there. I mean, just find something that you care about and have passion about and get involved. You know, we have a lot of 80-year-olds in our congregation, you know, or 90-year-olds even. You know, a lot of people, when you're 80 years old, you figure, well, it's time to sit back and let others do whatever. But Bob was involved, and he spent his time living, you know, right to the end.
Do you have anything that you want to share about him besides that, a little personal antidote that you think kind of typifies him?
That's a tough question. We came here 15 years ago, and at that time the church had been struggling, been on a, you know, 40-year decline like a lot of churches, and kind of questioning, can we maintain this large building? All this, you know, future was kind of in question. After we came, we'd grown somewhat in numbers, often maybe more in spirit. And so after a couple of years, we needed to do this facility renovation that was more of a statement of faith as much as it was a building, you know, program. But Bob was the chair of that. It was Faith in Our Future was the name of this deal. Bob led that. We committees like that are all a bunch of busy people who have a hard time finding a time to meet. So we met at 7 a.m. every Friday, which was fantastic for Bob because he loved Perkins. You know, we could eat at Perkins every Friday morning. But we got a new organ, new carpeting, new air conditioning, handicap accessibility, ramp. We raised more money than we were supposed to, and Bob was kind of the driving force behind all of that. And again, he saw it was a need, and he was committed to it, and just a fun guy, great person to know. And he was our dog sitter. So our our dog was actually staying with them because our floors were being refinished and we had to get out of the house. He was there when Bob took ill and had to go to the
hospital.
Were
you there for – you gave the blessing for the dog blessing.
Yeah.
I remember you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was actually interesting. It was a blessing at the church for your pets.
Yeah.
And it was held outside and people brought all their animals. There were a lot of dogs, few cats, you know. I didn't see any goats or anything.
Right,
but, you
right.
know.
Yeah,
it was
Bob and Jenna were there with Sadie. You know, they loved animals. So
he just made everything practical, made it approachable.
Yeah.
Do you find him kind of a rare item in communities, people like him?
Actually, I think there's a lot of people like him that don't get much publicity. They kind of quietly go about doing what they do. On the other hand, if everybody was like Bob, the world would be a, you know, a much better place.
More,
you know,
efficient.
Yeah, yeah. What I appreciated maybe more than anything is he really valued everybody. You know, it didn't matter, you know, your race or your social status or your sexual orientation or any of that stuff. He just – and there were people, you know, we had a family visit who were staying at Access, at, you know, the shelter for a while. And they just took them in, became good friends with these folks. And there's a lot of people like that, you know. He just was welcomed and appreciated, saw the gifts in everybody. So
that's really nice to hear. So we were talking about Robert Bob McCarley, 83, passed away August 19th at the Mary Lee Greeley Medical Center. And I'm with Pastor Dave Russell of the First Baptist Church here in Ames, and bringing you the story because there are a lot of unsung heroes in our lives, and Bob McCarley was one of ours.
Yeah.
I'm Cynthia McClure. I'm with Bob Angelisi, who was a faculty member with a supporter of KHY. His name was Robert Bob McCarley. He passed away recently. And I brought Mr. Angelisi in here, who's an Iowa State chemistry professor, to talk about his colleague and to share some stories.
Okay. Let me first start out saying a little bit about Bob and his experience in the chemistry department. He joined the department in 1957. I joined in 1963, and so we were colleagues until his retirement. We were colleagues really for about 30 years, a little bit more than 30 years. And
that's long. That's older than some of our listeners.
Yes. And during those 30 years, we were both called inorganic chemists, and we were among a group of about eight inorganic faculty members. And we generally taught freshman chemistry, and this was usually a large 250-student auditorium facility. And then in addition to freshmen, Bob and the others would teach upper-level inorganic courses at the undergraduate as well as the graduate level. And so we all rotated among these courses during our years in service. I guess one of the most important things I remember about Bob was that he was a really caring faculty member. He just loved students, and he always had their best interests in mind. So whenever a student came to him, or when he went to a student that had difficulty in his courses, he would try to work out the problem. Often it meant simply telling the student they needed to study harder than they already were. But Bob really was concerned about students to make sure that they had every opportunity for success. And in cases where students had personal problems that affected their performance in chemistry, he would sit down with them and talk about the situation and do what he could in order to get them back on track. He was just a very caring kind of person, somebody that probably spent a lot more time on that side of student life than most faculty members.
So that was a benefit for Iowa State to have such a character on staff.
It was. In his graduate work, he mentored about 45 master's and PhD students in their research, and this meant that he expected some research to get done. So,
no slacking.
No slacking. So he had this mission that he needed to make sure that they learned something and accomplished something, and in the process he often found that he needed to crack the whip a little bit, and he also needed to encourage them where they had some difficulties with focusing. But he always managed to handle those situations really in a caring kind of way. I guess I remember him also because he was a little bit different than other faculty members. In fact, his daughter called him a bit of a fashionista because one day he went out and bought a lime green leisure suit. And
this was in, what, the 70s?
This was in the early 70s, yes.
Polyester lime green leisure
suit.
That's
right, exactly. And I remember him wearing that suit. And I think he wore it long beyond the 70s, actually. But in addition, he always had a rather stylish hat that he wore. There were different varieties of hat that over the years, but it was always something that was really kind of special. It wasn't just an old, ordinary hat that others wore.
So he wasn't there just to be functional. He understood what he liked and he...
That's right.
He did it.
That's right. That's right. And in his early years, I remember... There was a rather, domineering chairman of the department, and one day he called Bob in for a chat about his mustache. Bob had grown a rather large mustache, and this chairman said, "You look like a gigolo, Carly."
So he had a bit of a, for the time, it was a nonconformist facial hair.
That's right. That's right. So
now that's becoming very retro, guys.
I think that's right.
Guys are getting back to that police officer 70s mustache.
I think that's right, yes.
So what happened with him? You know, he'd get called into, and well, what did you hear? What were the rumors around the office?
Oh, he kept the mustache. In fact, he grew a beard in addition to the mustache, so the chairman didn't phase his style at all.
He just did what he wore, his lime green leisure suit and his facial hair and his snazzy hats and helped
right.
students.
That's right.
He made an impression on people, I bet.
He did. He did. He always spoke, though, in a very kind manner. A very caring kind of person in everything he did. Obviously, this was also a feature of his interaction with the community. And I live at Green Hills Retirement Community, and Bob and Jenna also live there. And he has been on the board of directors at the Green Hills and is a person that just interacted with, in this case, mostly elderly people, some of whom had significant health issues that they were dealing with. But Bob was always the kind of person that really touched those people that had the personal difficulties, all the way from freshmen in college to seniors at Green Hills.
He made an impact on a lot of people's lives. We're remembering Bob McCarley, who passed away, and I'm with Bob Angelisi, his
yes.
longtime friend of 30 years, colleague, and just remembering somebody that did a good job in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go to the funeral?
Yes. The visitation the night before was very well attended. In fact, there were these running videos of Bob over the years, and one of the videos was of him attending his grandson's wedding in Colorado only about 3 weeks earlier, and he was dancing at the wedding. In fact, they had some very fast music that Bob was just really having a ball at. And I and John Vercade and Bob went to lunch about 2 weeks before Bob died, and we talked about this wedding, and Bob explained the video that had been taken of him dancing. He says, "I think it's going to go viral."
Well,
I said, "Viral? He said, well, maybe not. But then the grandson at the visitation said, I think it's going to be on the web, so we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you, sir. Do you have anything else you want to share with us about recollecting your dear friend who made an impact on student lives and on the quality of the life here in Ames?
He, of course, I'm going to miss him because he was a good friend, and we did go to lunch regularly since he retired, and he was just such a nice guy. There just are not many people like that.
I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Those interviews were with Pastor Dave Russell and retired professor of chemistry,
Bob Angelisi,
who knew a longtime supporter of KHY Community Radio, the late Robert Bob McCarley, whose impact on Central Iowa made all of our lives better for knowing him.
I seek to cross the river. I seek to ride the serpent. I seek to bathe my tender toes in wisdom. Fill my head with life. I seek the thunderbolt to strike. Release the inspiration lies in every cell of life. I seek to cross the river. I seek to ride the serpent. I seek to bathe my tender toes in wisdom. Fill my head with life. I seek the thunderbolt to strike. Release the inspiration lies in every cell of life. I seek to cross the river. I seek to ride the serpent. I seek to bathe my tender toes in wisdom. Fill my head with life. I seek the thunderbolt to strike. Release the inspiration lies in every cell of life. I seek to cross the river. I seek to ride the serpent. I seek to bathe my tender toes in wisdom. Fill my head with life. I seek the thunderbolt to strike. Release the inspiration lies in every cell of life. I seek to cross the river. I seek to ride the serpent. I seek to bathe my tender toes in wisdom. Fill my head with life. I seek the thunderbolt to strike. Release the inspiration lies in every cell of life.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I would like to thank our guests today, the Phenology Report, which was commemorating the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon and its impact on society by Aldo Leopold, read by Pat Schlarbaum, KPOTIC's Community Service Organization Appreciation Guest, Lead Interim Pastor John Carr of Bethesda Lutheran Church. Remember, if you have a community service organization that you would like to be featured on Local Talk, contact Kay Puttick at khoiradio@gmail.org. Each month, she features a different community service organization with at least one interview and also public service announcements featuring the chosen organization each day throughout the month. If you are in need of these services provided by the Clothing Closet and Food Pantry, they are both located at Bethesda Lutheran Church at 1517 Northwestern Avenue. Hours of operation for both the clothing closet and the food pantry are Monday and Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. until 11 a.m., and also Tuesday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. In addition, the food pantry is open on Tuesdays and Thursday afternoons from 1 to 3 p.m. The hours of operation can also be found at the church's website, BethesdaNet.org. I would also like to personally thank Pastor Dave Russell of the First Baptist Church in Ames and Bob Angelisi, a retired chemistry professor at Iowa State University, in remembrance of a man who was a supporter of KHOI from the beginning, the late Robert Bob McCarley. Thank you for sharing memories of a friend and colleague who made an impact on those around him with his outstanding character and generous nature. He made life in Central Iowa better for knowing him. Thank you for making this a show that creates community through communication. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past local talk shows online at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.